Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, podcasting to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And today it is a great pleasure to be speaking once again to our good friend Patrick M. Wood, Editor-in-Chief of Technocracy News and Trends, which you can find on the World Wide Interweb at www.technocracy.news, which I must admit is an address I've never heard of before, .news. Patrick joined us a number of times in the past to talk about matters related to technocracy, the Trilateral Commission and its vision for a so-called New Economic World Order, Agenda 2030 and Sustainable Development, and of course his very important book which came on to discuss called Technocracy Rising, the Trojan Horse of Global Transformation, which again I'm going to recommend to everybody to get a copy and read it, or at least go back through the archives and listen to the interview on that subject, or preferably both, I suppose. That would be the best thing. Pat Wood specialises in analysing trends in economics and politics and the historical analysis of globalism and its elites. And he's been an investment advisor since the mid-1970s and co-authored the famous two-volume book with Anthony Sutton called Trilaterals Over Washington. Pat, welcome back to the show.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for having me back on.
Well, thank you for coming on again, because it really is always great to speak with you, because so often with these things that we discuss on this show, particularly matters of a kind of a geopolitical nature in the broadest sense, we can get some idea of where things are going in the short term, but very often getting a longer term view is pretty difficult to discern. But I do think that your analysis in terms of technocracy, the global technocracy that you see shaping up as a kind of end game for the super elites provides, I think, a very helpful framework for analysing what's actually shaping up. So it's always great to get your perspective on things. And today we're going to be discussing around something that I think, well, on the face of it, it could sound a bit uninteresting. That's just because of the associations I have in my mind with the words that are involved. But it's actually really quite fascinating, something that is going to have an impact on our lives in the not too distant future, which we really do need to come to some sort of understanding about. And that's the subject of the Fourth Industrial Revolution, or Industry 4.0. or even Industry 4, as it's known in Germany, which seems to be where the idea was hatched. And that, of course, has been all the rage at Davos this year, when the various global keepers of the keys met in January to discuss how best to organise this world, what they consider, I think, to be their world in some way. So let's find out what all that fuss was about. So could you give us some idea about what the Fourth Industrial Revolution, or Industry 4, actually is? What do they mean when they talk about that?
You bet. I would like to go to the source and talk about it, because you already brought it up, the meeting in Davos. The World Economic Forum is the organization. It's a very elite group of global leaders that meet every year to discuss the latest and greatest what's going on. And I'm sure they have some interesting side discussions and stuff that you and I would not be privileged to listen in on, but
not quite sure.
This, you know, that's the case. But this is one of the topics that they brought out as a headline at this year's meeting, the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And to give some credibility to this, or at least some factual information, there was an article written by the founder and executive chairman of the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab. Now, you can't get any more authoritative than him, right? He wrote an article. It was published on the World Economic Forum website, so anybody can go there and verify that what I'm reading is exactly what he said. And this is a quote from the first paragraph. "We stand on the brink of a technological revolution that will fundamentally alter the way we live, work, and relate to one another. In its scale, scope, and complexity, the transformation will be unlike anything humankind has experienced before. We do not yet know just how it will unfold, but one thing is clear. The response to it must be integrated and comprehensive, involving all stakeholders of the global polity, from the public and private sectors to academia and civil society." Now, this is right out of his mouth. And although you can say on one hand it's pretty boring stuff, and, you know, people roll their eyes when you talk about Davos and you talk about the World Economic Forum, and yeah, they're all getting together. But listen, people ought to be interested in anything that's going to fundamentally alter the way we live, work, and relate to one another. I don't know what else there is in life besides those three things. We live, we work, and we relate to each other. Mm. So that means this transformation, and he says it's going to be unlike anything he's ever experienced before. People ought to be so critically interested in this that they ought to just be beating a path, you know, to get to the root of it.
Necessarily with these kinds of things, there's an element of hyperbole, isn't there? I mean, yes. Whoever he is to some extent a salesman. And so he's overstating this. But nevertheless, I mean, the thing that really sends a red flag to me is the stakeholders. You know, it's not just business. It's not just government. It's not just academia. It's everybody. You know, when I hear those sort of everybody-isms being thrown around in conversation or in these sort of sales pitches, I start to think, ah, this means some sort of elite that is telling people we have to do this in order to move the world in a certain way. And that's the kind of thing that sends a flag up for me.
That is a little bit disturbing. Now, the scope of this fourth industrial revolution, and maybe it shouldn't be called the industrial revolution, although it kind of goes along with the first, second, third, industrial revolutions, but this isn't so much industrial as it is electronic. It's driven by technology. And what he says, and this is accurate as far as I've read anywhere, he writes in the same article, and this is a quote again, the possibilities of billions of people connected by mobile devices with unprecedented processing power, storage capacity, and access to knowledge are unlimited. And these possibilities will be multiplied by emerging technology breakthroughs in fields such as artificial intelligence, robotics, the Internet of Things, autonomous vehicles, three-dimensional printing, nanotechnology, biotechnology, materials science, energy storage, and quantum computing. That's a mouthful.
It certainly is. And I said to you before the interview, I've been quite hard really to get my mind around everything that's involved here, because not only is that the mouthful that you've just expressed there, but the fact that you kind of have to imagine the unimaginable, you know, this is projecting into the future to things that people are really speculating about. And so it's difficult to get your head around what it is you're actually talking about. But when I went to the Wikipedia page about this, and, you know, as always, we have to say, oh, how can you trust a Wikipedia page? But, you know, when something is not particularly controversial, I think it's, you know, good as a first place to go to. And so I thought, okay, well, let's just sort of get some basic definitions about this. And what it suggested was that it was a mixture of basically three things. Now, obviously, you've mentioned more, but just to sort of focus down into three things here, they had on the Wikipedia page the idea of the cyber physical systems plus the Internet of Things plus the Internet of Services. Now, we've talked about the Internet of Things before, so we have some idea of what that is. But the other two, I'm not quite so clear about what cyber physical systems are. Would that be, presumably that is to do with artificial intelligence in connection with producing things, is that right?
That's absolutely correct. And when you see the word cyber, it usually refers to the mind or to the brain or some derivation. Of course, artificial intelligence is growing so rapidly right now that it's not even funny. And, you know, a lot of this stuff, I don't remember if we talked about Francis Schaeffer before.
We've talked about him on this show a lot, and he was a hero of mine, so yeah.
Okay, well, that's good. I approve. he's one of mine too, actually.
That's lucky.
But in his 10th film on How Should We Then Live, at the very end of it, he kind of summed up everything in the first 9 3/4 films. And he gave a prediction about where it was going. Oh, I wish he had lived another 20 years.
Yes.
You know, to kind of keep going. But he said at the end of it, where we're going in this postmodern world is technology is moving to a point where it will become viewed as magical. In other words, they'll be unable to distinguish between a real technology orchestrated by man and just outright magic. And that we're almost there. We're almost to that point where these concepts are like artificial intelligence. It's so far above our understanding that it almost just seems like magic. And robotics is almost the same way. And the Internet of Things just boggles your mind.
Absolutely. Are you saying then that it's, in your view, it's going to have a kind of bewitching effect upon people? They're likely to feel that somehow this is their salvation in some way, that because it's got a limitless potential.
Exactly. Artificial intelligence is one of those technologies that has snuck up on us. It's been in the mill for at least 25, 30 years, to my personal knowledge, and it hasn't had a lot of airplay before you know, just a couple, 3 years ago. But now that real breakthroughs are starting to be made in it, where there are commercially available products that demonstrate it, all of a sudden, boom, here it is. It's like it's right in our face. Mm-hmm. You know, smartphones have done a lot to bring the whole concept of artificial intelligence to our consciousness. You have with the iPhone, you have Siri, you know, the intelligent assistant. Microsoft has one. Google has one now. You know, everybody's using this. You ask a question in just plain English, you get an answer. Mm. You know, it may dial a phone for you, or it may pull up a web page. It may just give you the answer verbally. These are examples, small examples of artificial intelligence. And if listeners were to go to IBM.com/Watson, they can see a demonstration and listen to some of the feedback of their supercomputer that uses artificial intelligence called Watson. I think that was maybe a play on Sherlock Holmes. I'm not sure.
Yes, I guess so.
Watson, yeah. Would you come in here, please? I don't know. But IBM supercomputing artificial intelligence program is mind-blowing, absolutely mind-boggling. And this was the program, by the way, that was able in chess to beat the top-tier chess player in the world. And that's a small feat for Watson at this point. That was several years ago. But now it's being used for all kinds of things, from modeling the weather through solving complex scientific problems to answering political science questions, geopolitical questions, you name it. Watson is learning all about the world. At this point, almost autonomously.
It is incredible. But with respect to this business about the industrial revolution, as it's being called, this fourth industrial revolution, then it has a specific application to the way things are going to be produced. And I want to refer to an article by Daniel Oberhaus. He published this in Vice.com last year. I don't actually have it in front of me, so this is from memory. But when he started off that particular article, he sort of illustrated to get people, you know, some sort of idea about what we're talking about with this. And when he talked about something like your phone perhaps is on the edge of becoming obsolete or something, and even before you can think, oh, I need to order a new phone, under this new system that he's saying will actually emerge, you might find that your phone has in fact already been, your new phone has been ordered and it's on its way, and maybe it's even got all the settings that you put on it so that when it arrives to you, well, you find that it works just exactly the same as the previous one. So in that kind of scenario, you have a flow of information, which of course this connects to the Internet of Things that we've talked about, but also a kind of automation of the very industrial process. Maybe very few people, if anybody's involved in this as a conscious human being, but the artificial intelligence has decided what you need through the information that's being used and has instructed various manufacturing processes to do their thing. And there it is in front of you in the post. And so, I mean, in some ways you could say, well, that's tremendously convenient. Wonderful. What a fantastic future that would be. You'd hardly need to do anything, just sit back and everything would just happen for you. But on the other hand, there are some very scary implications. I mean, certainly immediately, I think, in terms of privacy. But I mean, that's just one aspect of it. There are all sorts of ways in which this worries me. And how do you feel about that?
Yeah, wow. What comes to my mind is the concept of systems theory. Systems theory has to do with the building of closed systems that make things work together, interoperate together. When you take artificial intelligence and you give it the means to learn and you give it a tool like systems theory to figure things out, what the artificial intelligence does then, when it goes out to analyze things, is to try and connect all the dots on how things work, what things are related to each other. And it'll attempt to build a system, a network diagram, at least in its own brain, on how things ought to work. And what you just described is exactly that, is taking what you can discover of previous activity and new possibilities that are available now that weren't available back then, any changes in your lifestyle, your mindset, or whatever, and putting all that together and coming up with some type of, you know, reasonable expectation of what you want next. You know, in other words, what you want, okay, what do you want in the next 5 minutes now? This is one of the core functions of technocracy, is this idea of systems theory. They use this everywhere. Everywhere they go, you'll see this methodology applied. It's a little bit distracting when you understand it. It's like, God, I don't think I'd like to be analyzed as a system, you know, in my environment. But that's the way they look at us. You know, if you take a feedlot, out west here, we have feedlots, you know, 50,000, 75,000 head of cattle. They're managed very scientifically. Their feed is mixed for them scientifically. They weigh them all the time to make sure that they are gaining weight, and they give them shots for different things. And, you know, it's a very scientific process. But they run the whole feedlot according to a systems theory. And everything integrates down on what's good for the cattle, you know, to get the maximum amount of weight gain before they have to go off to become hamburger or steaks.
Oh, dear. Yeah.
And, you know, this is systems theory. Well, scientists and engineers and technocracy, et cetera, you know, this is the way they look at it. This is the way the whole system is geared to just make us one big system and then figure out how to analyze this, you know, what we want to do next. And another good example of that is the whole concept right now of pre-crime analysis, where police and intelligence agencies are trying to use big data to determine where a crime might take place and by who. It's a little bit like the Minority Report movie from, I think, 2000. Yes. Artificial intelligence. Again, this is it. They're using the same concepts of system theory to look at the mind of a person or a group of people to determine their past behavior, anything new that's added in right now, and a new stimulus, whatever, and then who's liable to commit a crime out of that, and let's go head them off before they do.
Yeah,
it's actually being used in the world today.
Well, one of the reasons, I think, why it's difficult to get your head around this, as you say, it's about systems and processes, which is always more difficult to get your head around than objects. And looking back at this description of these cyber-physical systems, there's a whole load of jargon associated with it. Just go through some of these things. Interoperability, I can hardly say that word. Interoperability, virtualization, decentralization, real-time capacity, service-oriented design, modularity, and all these things seem to be descriptions of the ability of the system to work in certain kinds of ways. Very little of that, I find, is easy to pin down quite what it means because it's so fluid. But that's precisely it. In a way, it's about describing how this system works and its different components.
Well, we're trying, yeah, what we're trying to do is use systems theory to figure out how system theory is going to work in the future.
Right.
We're trying to put it together.
And this is
okay,
so,
what actually is going to happen?
Way up in the sky in comparison with things like the, you know, we've had before with the other industrial revolutions, which they've defined notionally as originally the water and steam mechanized production, so the late 18th century, early 19th century. So things like the mechanical loom, and then the electrical mechanized production, division of labor, so things like conveyor belts in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And then the third one, the computing based mechanized production of the late 20th century, so information technology. I mean, all those sorts of things, I suppose, because we've experienced them, and so we know what we're talking about with those. But nevertheless, with this fourth one, it does seem to be a real gear shift into something much more nebulous with these cyber-physical systems and these smart factories.
Well, exactly. And the robotic revolution right now, I think the latest story that I posted on technocracy.news was that Google's robot called Atlas spells the end of manual labor.
Right.
I tell you what, talk about a disruptive technology. And that's not just what I say about it. That's what other people are saying about it. And this humanoid type robot that Google has developed through the company they bought called Boston Dynamics, it is very humanoid. It's very fluid. The motions are very human-like. It can walk, it can stumble, it can get up if it falls down.
It's incredible.
It's absolutely an incredible technology. Mm. And it can, you know, it can lift things up off the ground and put them on shelves. And, you know, when they say that Atlas spells the end of manual labor, it's not just the robot. Let's just forget the robot for a second. Manual labor, you know, people working in warehouses, people working in offices where they're maybe doing filing or they do receptionist, and how about fast food industry, restaurants, stuff like that. That's about half of the entire workforce of the world. you're not just talking about displacing a few jobs. Like, you know, people say, always point back to the, you know, the horse and buggy days when the automobile came along. Well, you know, everybody's upset. All the buggy makers and the horse whip makers, you know, they were all out of business. Well, okay, that was a big deal back then. But it wasn't that big a deal because it didn't really affect the whole. I mean, not everybody was a buggy maker, right? or a leather worker. And so today, when you talk about affecting or impacting up to half of the labor force of the entire world, wow, that's a huge disruptive technology to society. Sure. And of course, it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take time. It's going to mature. It's going to be kind of gradual. But the way the technology is racing forward right now, my goodness, I mean, in 5 years, they're expecting to have fully functional humanoid type robots to be able to work in factories and stuff. Mm. So, you know,
that figure of almost half of the working population, you haven't plucked that out of thin air, have you? I mean, I found a reference to that with an Oxford University publication from 2013 called The Future of Employment, How Susceptible Are Jobs to Computerization by Carl Benedict Frey and Michael A. Osborne. So anybody can go and check that. And just a quote from this, this is from their abstract. Their assessment is that the, quote, impacts of future computerization on U.S. labor market is likely to be 47% of total U.S. employment is at risk. So that's exactly what you've said, almost 50% of the working population.
That's right.
Incredible.
That's right. And it's probably greater in other less industrialized countries. You know, like if you go to Africa, for instance, where, you know, about 80% of people are manual labor, that, you know, it's going to be even worse for them. The only good thing we have for America right now is that if we have robots entering the workforce here in America, at least that will mean companies won't have to move to China to get cheap labor. But that's right. I say that facetiously.
Yeah, so yeah, the curious thing there, so they'll actually bring a manufacturer back onto home ground, but it won't necessarily mean any more jobs for anybody.
Well, that's exactly right. But, you know, if you're a company, why bother hiring an infallible human, or excuse me, a fallible human, when you can buy a fallible robot for $25,000 each? You'd pay a worker maybe $50,000. You can buy, you know, two robots for one worker, and you don't have to replace them maybe every 3 or 4 years or something, and they don't strike. They don't want overtime, and you can work them 24 hours a day. You know, that's kind of slave labor at its best, right? And nobody's going to complain because, after all, it's just a machine, not a person.
But doesn't it mean that we're going to have all this extra free time? You know, if we don't have to go out to work, then we'll be able to just sit back and enjoy all these wonderful goods, and nobody will actually have to move any machines around or any boxes around. We'll just enjoy everything.
I know. I remember something. Something is in the back of my head about if you don't work, you don't eat, or something like that. You know, I don't think there's going to be a free lunch here to get, you know, free goods made by these robots. They're still going to charge for them no matter what. And there's going to be the haves and the have-nots. That's always been the problem, really, in the world, haves and the have-nots. But this is going to be exacerbated by this whole thing in such an incredible way. The elite will grow smaller and more powerful.
Right. Yeah.
And the rest of everybody will grow weaker and more impoverished by it.
But that's not what Davos says, is it? They have this white paper. They admit there's a problem there, but they seem to be really sanguine about it. I mean, let me just quote from them. This is from page 14 of their white paper. It's got a dreadful title, Extreme Automation and Connectivity. Anyway, this is page 14. Quote, while technological revolutions often stoke fears of declining employment as, quotes, robots do all the work, end quote. We believe a decline in aggregate employment is unlikely. The fourth industrial revolution could improve the productivity of existing jobs or create demand for entirely new jobs. And then they go on to say, it's usually difficult to envision today what the jobs of the future might be, but we believe that extreme automation and extreme connectivity could actually increase demand for customized human work. So they admit that they haven't really got much of an idea how this is going to work out for ordinary people, for you and me, but they believe. That's all they say. They don't give any example how. They just believe it's going to work out okay for us.
Well, they do. And, you know, honestly, there's really no logic behind how they can say this. Schwab himself, in his, the paper I referenced at the beginning, said in the future, technological innovation will also lead to a supply-side miracle with long-term gains in efficiency and productivity. I mean, a supply-side miracle? You know, how's that going to help anybody? If you're out of work, how are you going to buy these things?
Yeah.
Just doesn't make any sense. I mean, yeah, you'd be making stuff all over the place, but it's not an answer. It's just kind of hype as much as anything.
Mm.
But yeah, they talk about raising the global income levels and improving the quality of life for populations around the world, as this article says. It's like,
right,
okay,
right.
Could you tell me exactly how you're going to do that, please? Give me a suggestion. And they can't. They don't have any suggestion. They don't have any answers. They say, well, it's going to work out. You'll see.
Well, there's one way in which I could think that it might in inverted commas, work out would be to move in the direction that you've been talking about for so long, which is some kind of technocratic credit system where people are just given a credit and you have to spend that and you just wait to be doled out with another one. But what people would actually be doing, I suppose, would be sort of subsistence credits, really.
That's right. Yeah, you wonder at some point with all the people out of work that we see coming, there will have to be some type of forced work provided by the government or the governance system that will tell you if you don't have a legitimate job, then you need to go do these things. But on the other hand, we'll give you a welfare allotment or whatever so you can live.
But they talk about creativity, increased creativity. So perhaps people could be forced to be bad poets and bad composers and things. I don't know.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, we see shades of that right now. It was just announced, I think, this week, a new statistic, of course, but something like 47 or 8% of Americans do not pay income tax. You know, that's staggering. Almost half of the country doesn't pay income tax. That means the operation of the entire country, including all of the welfare that's given to the people that don't pay any taxes, is resting on half the population. Staggering, absolutely staggering. So you add these disruptive technologies on top of that, just to kind of see where is it going. We have no crystal ball. We cannot, you know, we can't predict specifically, but we know the overall meme, and it's not in a good direction at all.
Do you think that with all this massive talking up of this Industrial Revolution 4.0, I4, with all this talking up at Davos, do you think that it's a kind of distraction, a denial of the current economic realities, you know, because so many people are talking about the world economy being on knife edge, ready for a collapse, many saying this year. Or do you think there's evidence here of a vision that they have that extends beyond the current economic order? They're not talking about that, but they actually have a vision for a new economic order in which, you know, things like money and markets as we understand them just are going to be things of the past. Do you think they have that vision in mind?
I think they do. And I think, the global banks and the central banks are all talking about a cashless society now.
Yeah, yeah.
About taking cash out of society altogether. There's been many people talk, top economists even, talking about an energy-based currency or a carbon-based currency, which is be the same thing. They haven't actually put a policy down and said, okay, we're going to do this next year. But the fact that they're talking about it tells me that, you know, that's what comes first, right? That's, you know, you put the gunpowder in the bullet first, and then eventually, you know, you fire the bullet. And so this is building up to it, clearly.
Yes, it does seem to be. You know, many people are talking about this current economic situation we're in as being, you know, very experimental. And I mean, people are talking about negative interest rate policy and discouraging people from saving and getting them to spend more and getting rid of cash so people can't escape that. And, by saving money under their proverbial mattresses, it all seems so artificial and managed. It very much reminds me, you know, of technocracy, really, what you've been saying for so long.
Well, technocracy is talked about more and more today than ever before. I've seen this in the press now, in the media, and it's not just because I'm talking about it and they're picking it up for me. You see people talking about technocracy more, especially in Europe, even more so in Europe than in America.
Sure. But I mean, I agree that the word technocracy is being used more and more, but it doesn't necessarily need to be that the word is used. There's something so increasingly artificial and managed about the economy.
Yes.
That it doesn't seem to be a market economy at all anymore. You know, it's so manipulated. I think, well, the essence of a technocratic economic system is manipulation from the top. And pretty much that's what's shaping up, it seems.
Well, it is. And I would remind listeners, too, that Christiana Figueres, who was the head of climate change at the United Nations, last year, about a year ago, said in a press conference in Europe, she said, this is the first time in the history of mankind that we're setting ourselves the task of intentionally within a defined period of time to change the economic development model that has been reigning for at least 150 years since the Industrial Revolution, close quote. This tells you that they understand the stakes exactly. You know, the WEF understands the stakes. The United Nations has been implementing this new economic system, and they're fully on board with it, fully on board. And so when somebody like the head of climate change says that there is a timetable, number one, that there is a mindset to do it, number two, and that it's going to completely change the economic development model that we've known for the last 150 years, which is only free enterprise and capitalism all throughout the world, that tells you what they're up to. They're creating this new economic system called sustainable development that is an economic term, not a political term. It's an economic term. And they're gradually taking over all the means of production and consumption on a global basis. That's what it's all about.
So do you see the current economic crisis as being something that is brought about deliberately in order to precipitate this new situation? Or do you think it is opportunism, really?
Wow, you backed me into a corner on that one real fast.
Sorry about that.
That's good. Well, no, I mean, you smoked me out of that one. You know, there's two ways to look at this. One is that stuff happens. You know, the world has problems, and that's just the way it is. Other people would look at it and say it's all a plot. You know, it's a big conspiracy. And I don't think either one of them is right at this point. But I will say this. Stuff does happen. We know that. Historically, stuff does happen. And the global elite have always said, never let a good crisis go to waste. You know, So if there is a natural crisis, you can expect they're going to try to exploit it. However, the global elite have believed, the people that are behind technocracy have believed for years that the only way for technocracy to rise is for capitalism to crater and crash. They've believed that. They've stated it. They've written about it. And if that's the case, when you take a group of people like the World Economic Forum, the movers and shakers of the world, they know all this stuff. They can read just as easily as you and I can. They read the important people, right? And so here we have set up a moral hazard, at the very least a moral hazard, where if it were possible for somebody to give the economy a push, to kind of push Humpty Dumpty off the wall, you know, it's still going to crash either way. You can either fall off and crash, or maybe we could help them along a little bit. Would they do it? If they were in a position to do it, would they do it? And you have to answer the question, knowing the character of these people in the first place, to see, yeah, they probably would. As long as it didn't shoot off their own toes, you know, and hurt them directly immediately, they probably wouldn't mind giving it a little shove. I remember thinking back when George Bush was president, I had a very same question that you just asked. Because Bush was spending money like a drunken sailor. It hit me as being strange that, you know, we can't afford this. We don't have the income coming in. You're running up national debt. In fact, he increased national debt more than all the presidents in history behind him. Obama came along, and he has increased debt more than all the presidents behind him, including Bush.
Yes, it's incredible, you know, isn't it? Well, debt is something that nobody ever needs to worry about. It's an infinite thing.
I know. So here they are spending like drunken sailors, and you know, at some point, the debt system is not going to be sustainable. Everybody knows this. Even the central banks knows this. We're rolling over right now into a global deflationary period that would spell the end of debt, just generally, which if and of course, capitalism is a debt-based type economic system. And if debt implodes on a global basis, that means banks will go out of business. That means central banks will go bankrupt and go out of business. It means companies that have debt will probably go out of business. In other words, you have a global depression of major, major magnitude. And are they helping us along? Well, I see policies coming out of the Bank for International Settlements, for instance, that seem suicidal to me. You know, central banks going to negative interest rates, that also is suicidal. Why are they doing this? Why are they going after suicidal behavior? You can't answer it just by looking at the surface of it. But, you know, maybe that's part of it. Maybe they're trying to shove the system into its final collapse so that out of the ashes, you know, like the great phoenix bird, right? Out of the ashes will rise a new global economic system that will be known as literally as technocracy. There was an article written by Jeremy Rifkin in 2015.
I've heard of him, yes.
Yes, he's a pretty well-known guy. He speaks to the global elite, and you know, he's been a futurist and a progressive for some time. He wrote an article in 2015 called, in a headline, How the Third Industrial Revolution Will Create a Green Economy. And in that article, as well as others he's written in the past, he said that the green economy will emerge after the collapse of capitalism. That wasn't necessarily making a causative prediction, you know, like, go do that, guys, you know, like, okay, let's go do that, collapse capitalism. But he's making an observation that obviously he sees. That's how it's going to happen. So, you know, the global elite, they're not stupid. And they listen to people like Rifkin, and they say, okay, we get it. You know, there's tough times coming for capitalism, but on the other side of the divide, you know, there's going to be happy days for those who prepare for it and are, you know, going to emerge as the new global leadership in the economy.
If we go back to the actual nitty-gritty of this Industry 4 system, which may flower the other side of what we've been talking about in their vision, in one sense, you could look upon it as being very authoritarian because it requires a massive standardization of processes across computing and manufacture and information. And, you know, it's like a control grid. But on the other hand, isn't there a possibility that it could be a potential for us as ordinary people to use that technology? I mean, in the sense that we benefited in the past, for example, you know, computing has been through a massive investment, you know, it's been developed, but then it's been used by the small business, you know. So is it not the case that the systems of Industry 4 could actually be used by ordinary people as long as we had the right mindset that we weren't going to give in to big business solutions all the time, that we could form our own networks and use this technology?
Well, that's a great question. I am very pro technology, by the way. I'm not a technology basher in any way.
Right.
I believe that technology can be used for good or evil, depending on who's using it. Like money, you know, money is not evil in itself. The Bible says so, but it does say the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil. So,
yes. You
know, it's the love of money, and the idea there is if you use money to control and manipulate people, that's when you get into trouble with money. And that's where you get in trouble with technology. Yeah. I love technology on one hand, when it serves me and it helps me do my work better and my job better and my life better. You know, if I need a medical thing that is now possible and it wasn't 20 years ago, I'm certainly glad I have it. So technology has a great benefit to mankind on one hand. Mm. But the problem here with technocracy is these engineers and scientists that develop technocracy, they want to control the entire planet through this system of technocracy that they've devised as a replacement economic system. And they've never varied. They've never changed their opinion. And the actual definition of technocracy from 1938, from the Technocrat magazine, this is the heart of it today, too. It could have been written yesterday. This is a quote from their magazine. Technocracy is the science of social engineering, the scientific operation of the entire social mechanism to produce and distribute goods and services to the entire population, close quote. That's it. They want to control the means of production and consumption through technology. And, you know, historically, this is not communism, by the way. It's not socialism or communism either. It's a different animal, but there's lots of similarities. And I would want to say, relating to communism especially, the idea or the lust for controlling production and consumption has never worked out for the citizens of a country. You think of China, you think of Russia, the USSR, you know, the other failed socialist states, Cuba, communist states, and where communism has been practiced in South America. It has never, ever worked, not in even one single instance. So now these scientists and engineers are saying, basically, well, everybody else has tried it, but we think we're different. Mm. We can make the system work because we invented the technology. So just let us engineer society. Let us control the mechanism to produce and distribute goods to the entire population. We will tell the population what they're allowed to consume, and we will tell the population, the business people, what they're allowed to make, and everything will be most efficient. You'll see. Just trust us on this, you know?
Yes.
And you see, the problem is, even back in those days in 1933, as FDR was stepping into the presidency, technocrats wrote openly, there was a book published with this actually in print, they encouraged Roosevelt to declare himself dictator in order to implement technocracy, and they wanted to just simply dismiss Congress in our country. Just tell them to go home.
Yeah, but I suppose I could imagine some of these people thinking, you know, with their sort of scientific hubris, that now technology has become so advanced that it would be possible to undercut that classic criticism of the command economy, you know, where you could say there's no way that the command economy can take the place of a true marketplace, because that's where all the interrelations and information and the pricing mechanisms take place inside the marketplace. There's no system that can reproduce that. But I can imagine some of these people thinking, oh, well, now we can, because we have such vast computing and artificial intelligence, then it is, in fact, possible to work all that out. How would you respond to that?
I believe that's the point of deception right there, is that they have this technology at their disposal now, and they're hoodwinked into thinking that they can really pull it off and everybody will be happy. But I don't imagine everybody will be happy. You know, the transhuman movement is in the same boat. And transhumanism is the Siamese twin to technocracy, because they're both based on scientism.
Yeah.
And the transhuman movement is hoodwinked into thinking that new technology will actually help them to achieve immortality and omniscience, qualities reserved for God. And prior to technology being what it is today, transhumanism, for instance, was merely a metaphysical proposition. They had no evidence that they could actually do it, but it was a metaphysical idea that man could achieve immortality on his own, somehow on his own. You know, they never did it. Not one man ever did it. They all died trying to do it, but they never gave up hope.
Sure. I want to talk to Martin Erdman about that, because he's very interested in the Rosicrucian roots of transhumanism, which, of course, connects immediately to what you're saying there. But that'll have to be an interview for some time in the future.
That's right. And so, you know, technology has been a great deceiver, or at least an agent of deception, to convince these people that, boy, we got it in our reach right now. We're just that close, you know, to really making it happen. But the fact is, for instance, in transhumanism, technology has not gotten them one step closer to immortality over the last 40 years. It hasn't. You know, some of them will even admit that. They haven't made it. And so they're still waiting. You know, they're still waiting for a breakthrough that will actually take them a step closer to immortality. And when you look at technocracy, it's kind of the same thing. It's all the Pollyanna stuff. You know, oh, we're going to solve the poverty problem all around the world. Everybody's going to have jobs with dignity. Everybody's going to have lifelong learning opportunities, et cetera. Oh, life is going to be so wonderful. You'll see, everybody's just going to have all this extra time, and they're going to be able to play and relate to each other and blah, blah, blah. And yet, behind the promises, look down on the text a little bit, at the fine print, you know, like on the drug ads on TV when they come in with all the side effects, you know, and may result in death. Okay. You know, you look down on the fine print and you say, oh, all you need to do is give us the means of production and consumption.
Yeah, one thing that crossed my mind there, you said, you know, these sort of small print things may result in death or whatever. And I was just wondering, actually, I don't see why it should be ruled out of court in this. Would be population control. I mean, I don't see why in a system that is supposed to be based upon maximum efficiency at all times, why one wouldn't consider human life to be one of the variables in this equation of efficiency. And speaking purely rationally, that is without any sense of the transcendent value of human beings, which I don't think is necessarily part of technocracy, why one might not just say, well, let's extract a certain number of human beings from that system to make it work more efficiently. And that would certainly be an answer to the employment problem.
It definitely would. And population control has been part of the Agenda 21 platform since it was created in 1992. It's actually written into the core document. They don't say how they're going to achieve it, but, you know, through attrition, perhaps through maybe low food production, you know, abortion, stuff like that, they might achieve a lower population. But interesting, not too long ago, two or three years ago, Al Gore, who was a member of the Trilateral Commission, you remember, and he's also the head guy, kind of the poster child of global warming and sustainable development. Al Gore suggested, at a World Economic Forum event, by the way, okay. We were just talking about that, he suggested that fertility management is the key to fighting global warming. That's just a huge statement. This is eugenics being used as a prop with a political agenda at the end of it attached.
It very much reminds me of that book by John Holdren and Paul Ehrlich and Ann Ehrlich. Was it Eco-Science?
Yes.
So this is back in the 1970s. I believe that John Holdren has sort of distanced himself from that book.
Yeah.
But, you know, what people really believe and what they say are not necessarily the same thing. Of course, he's the senior advisor still, isn't he, to President Obama on science and technology. Mm-hmm. And yet in that book, there are some astonishing things that are suggested. Involuntary sterilization, sterilants in the drinking water, compulsory abortions. And then they even suggest a planetary regime to regulate all of this. I mean, the very idea that those things are being talked about is just dreadful.
Oh my gosh, it was dreadful. And you know, Paul Ehrlich, who wrote The Population Bomb, what was it, 1968, was it? Or 69, somewhere back there.
Yeah, something like that.
It's been translated into about every language on the planet, and it sold millions of copies around the world. And looking back now historically, there has not been one single prediction Paul Ehrlich made that has come to pass. Not a single one. His entire book has been discredited time and time again.
He still believes in it, though, doesn't he?
Well, he does still. He not only believes in it, but listen, he claimed basically that overpopulation is going to completely destroy the planet, and that we'll be standing shoulder to shoulder and have to resort to cannibalism to stay alive. Nobody bothered to mention along the way that his field of science was entomology. That's the study of bugs, you know, like crickets and locusts and whatever. And he applied his knowledge of bug science to humans. And he wrote a book about it. This is how he extrapolated that, you know, if humans were to breed like locusts, the world would be swarmed with people. You know, here we are today. He still believes this. And people around the world believe this just as gospel truth. We have to get rid of people. It's crazy. It's just insane.
Yeah. I was just thinking that I don't know whether people have looked at that book, Ecoscience, but I've just got a couple of quotes here from it, which is quite astonishing.
Yes.
A program of sterilizing women after their second or third child, despite the relatively greater difficulty of the operation than vasectomy, might be easier to implement than trying to sterilize men. This, of course, would be feasible only in countries where the majority of births are medically assisted. Unfortunately, such a program, therefore, is not practical for most less developed countries, although in China, mothers of three children are commonly expected to undergo sterilization. It's so clinical, you know, the development of a long-term sterilizing capsule that could be implanted under the skin and removed when pregnancy is desired opens additional possibilities for coercive fertility control. The capsule could be implanted at puberty and might be removed with official permission for a limited number of births. No capsule that would last that long, 30 years or more, has been yet been developed, but it's technically within the realm of possibility. And then he talks about this, they talk about this planetary regime as well. So the planetary regime might be given responsibility for determining the optimum population for the world and for each region and for arbitrating various countries' shares within their regional limits. I mean, this is incredible. I mean, you know, yes. People need to read that.
It is. I don't know if I shared with you before my personal testimony with the eugenics movement.
No, you didn't.
But it started in Northern California at Berkeley, University of California at Berkeley primarily. That was the hotbed of eugenics back in the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. My grandmother, who was a young lady in those days, unfortunately was completely spellbound by what the doctors were saying about eugenics and how we needed to clean up the gene pool and et cetera, et cetera. Her firstborn son had mental problems, mental deficiency, born retarded. And they discovered when he was about 5 or 6 that he probably would not develop any more beyond that. And that, you know, that it was a genetic problem. So when my mother was born a few years later, my grandmother was very concerned that this genetic thing would pass through my mother and that she would have retarded children. And actually, I'll say now, I was adopted by my mother, and I'll tell you why. But when my mother was 17, before she went off to college, my grandmother listened to the doctors, the eugenics doctors, and took my mother down to the hospital. I was 17 years old, and they put her on an operating table, and they sterilized her so she couldn't have children. Because they were certain it was going to, you know, well, too much chance anyway, it would produce more retarded babies, and they didn't want that. Years later, when my, that would have been my uncle, of course, that was retarded, he was in a care institution, and a doctor examined him and studied his history a little bit more, a non-eugenics doctor, I might add, and discovered that he really didn't have anything genetically wrong with him, but he had the umbilical cord had been wrapped around his neck when he was born, and he suffered an oxygen deprivation, which caused mental impairment.
Yeah.
And so there was really nothing wrong with him at all. And when my mother found that out, on top of just being sterilized anyway, she didn't take it very well, I have to say. She didn't have much of a relationship with her mother for the rest of her life either.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so I was adopted. That's how it just happened to be that my actual birth mother and father were on the boat immigrating from Holland to the United States. And they disembarked in San Francisco. She was pregnant on the boat, and she had had me right soon after that at Children's Hospital in San Francisco. And they had no way to support a child at that point, so they put me up for adoption. That's how I got adopted by my mother. It's the only person I ever knew is my mother. It's a horrific story, and I've reflected on that personally so many times about how evil, there's no other word you can use, it's just flat out evil that these people conjure up.
Sure. Yeah, thank you for sharing that with us. I mean, the thing that comes to my mind is the playing God.
Yes.
Pretending to be omniscient. And there a mistake is made because it's overreaching, or well, you know what the problem is, but actually you didn't know what the problem was at all. And I can imagine the potential for that to increase with the complexity of the kind of systems that we're talking about. I mean, do you think that the moral aspect of this technocratic future that we've been talking about is there? Do you think there really is a moral view? Or do you think that human beings will in fact be treated just as one component amongst others? You know, I haven't read all the way through the publications that you've suggested to me in the past, but from what I've picked up, I haven't really come across any sense of transcendence, transcendent values about any of it.
No, the system is completely amoral.
Right.
There is no concept of morality as you and I would understand it. It's completely amoral. Decisions are not made based on anything but the scientific method. If science says it, that's it.
So there's no in principle reason then why human beings should be valued other than some sort of cultural norm.
That's exactly correct. And what's really sad, and this is a futuristic thought looking forward, but in a society where intelligence is valued, or higher intelligence is extremely valued, what happens to the people that don't have as much intelligence? You know, what happens to the people who maybe only have an IQ of, say, 80 or 90? They're people too, but they're not going to be esteemed whatsoever. If you're not capable of getting a PhD in some kind of scientific field, you're basically just a grunt. We've got robots already that can do your job. So all you are is just consuming feed. In other words, they would look at them and say, you are a cancer cell in the body of society.
And they have used terminology like that. The Club of Rome has used terminology like that in the past, haven't they?
Yes. We know what you have to do with cancer. You have to get rid of those cells.
Yeah. As you say, though, this isn't a property of the technology itself.
No,
I mean, this is a property of the elitist, self-preserving systems that wish to use that technology in a certain kind of way. Now, if that is the case, then surely the way out of this, if there is a way out of this, is for people to become aware that this technology is something that we can use, and we need to keep alert to that fact and to look to ways in which we as individuals and as independent grassroots connections of people can use these technologies so that we can somehow move ourselves off the grid that they are trying to create. And they seem to be working, you know, at full pace, trying to create this massive global infrastructure that we can't extract ourselves from. But if we keep alert, we look for creative ways of doing things independently, do you think there's a chance that we can achieve that and we can actually come off that control grid in the future?
It's going to be difficult to do that. Because, you know, for instance, we see things like the cashless society coming. If they remove cash from society, that basically sends you and me back to a system of bartering. If we want to stay out of the system, we're basically just going to have to barter.
But could you do what is in fact done in many places, have an independent local currency? You know, that gets over the problem of barter, doesn't it?
It's entirely possible, but it will be illegal, you understand. It will be black market, and it will be anti-government. So, you know, you get pressure for sure. I think what people need to do is to confront the real problem. The real problem is not politicians. The problem is the technocrats that are behind them, that have this godlike egocentricity that they want to run the world. You know, that they want to make the world into their own image. A lot of people just can't conceive that there are individuals like that that are operating at the global level. But there are. They're in our country. They're in your country. They're in every country in Europe. They're in the EU. They're in China. I think every member of the Politburo in China has an advanced scientific degree. In other words, like a PhD type degree. And they're all engineers and scientists. And they're running the country right now as a scientific project.
Let me jump in there that you're not saying that all scientists and engineers are part of this way of thinking.
Not at all. I think it's a relatively small proportion of them. It's just that they happen to be in positions of influence where politicians are trusting them or will trust them and go along with them. But it is not all scientists and engineers any more than it's all technology is being, you know, used against us. But here's the mentality. Here's going back all the way back to like 1800 with the French philosopher Henri de Saint-Simon. And he is the father of scientism, by the way, as you know. He said, quote, "A scientist, my dear friends, is a man who foresees. It is because science provides the means to predict that it is useful. And scientists are superior to all other men," close quote. You see, this is a Hitlerian type statement in a way, you know, that science, and it's very religious. Science can predict the future. A scientist, but only a scientist, is a man who foresees. So you can't foresee, I can't foresee, but a scientist can. And the biggest statement here is that scientists are superior to all other men. This is a dangerous proposition. When somebody stands up and says, "I am superior to all other men," that sounds like almost like the Antichrist, doesn't it?
Wow. I must admit, the way the word predict is being used there does not really suggest what I normally think of as scientific prediction, where you're hypothesizing, you're extrapolating, you say it may turn out this way, etc. Well, let's see, and if that confirms my hypothesis, then great. That doesn't seem to be the way that that word is being used. As you say, it seems more like this foresight of the superior people. That sounds something close to claim to omniscience.
This is a very dangerous mindset, in my opinion. It's the most dangerous mindset to mankind. This is the mindset, by the way, that Hitler did have. And it was the technocrats that were in his administration, if you will, that allowed him to do the things that he did during World War II. The scientists and engineers enabled Hitler to do what he set out to do. And they viewed themselves as superior to all other men. And as a result, and just as a springboard off that, Hitler viewed himself as superior to all other men as well.
Chosen by nature with a big N.
That's right.
So, I mean, how do we get these technocrats off our backs then? So we can't vote them out of office because they're not in office. What do we do?
Well, certainly we have to raise awareness to people that there even is this problem. Because most people, I mean, really 99% of the people don't even see this at all, what we're talking about here. And that doesn't make us superior to all other men either.
No. Well, I get the impression that people, they are aware that there is a super class, or super classes, I suppose we should say. But nevertheless, the impression that I get with most people is that they believe there are, well, there's this billionaire here, and there's this multi-billionaire here and there, and they're looking after their own interests, and they have various investments, etc. But the idea of them somehow combining to achieve anything, that's conspiracy theory, even though you only need a handful of people to do such in order to achieve something nefarious. Nevertheless, no, that's conspiracy theory because we can't even think that. That's a big barrier, isn't it?
Yes. It's not the billionaires, I don't think, we have to worry about, although they are aggravating and they're visible. We can see them. But the technocrats that operate behind the scenes are operating in a curious partnership with the rich, like, you know, the George Soros of the world and the David Rockefellers of the world and so on. And the rich elite are giving the technocrats an opportunity to practice their black magic by giving them money, by providing them laboratories, by giving them position, whatever, you know, to take their research forward. But you say, who's really in control? Is it the billionaires that are in control, or is it the technocrats that are in control? We see Hitler had technocrats during World War II. He himself was not a scientist or an engineer, but he knew how to coexist with them. He knew how to use them. They knew how to operate, you know, kind of as a symbiotic relationship, right? And that's what's exactly what's happening today. When the Trilateral Commission picked up on technocracy back in 1973, they, in a sense, adopted that as their means to an end to control the world. They like this business of production and consumption. Give it all to us. We want it all. We want all the resources. We want all the control over the whole world. They saw that as an opportunity. They've been using each other. The global elite have been using the technocrats, and the technocrats have been using the politicians.
Right.
And they've been coexisting. They are not the same groups. They don't have the same interests. My guess is they probably hate each other's guts.
So when we talk to people then and we point to the superclasses and we talk in terms of the billionaires, then that's only half the picture and perhaps a bit of a distraction, therefore, because that's the obvious thing. We need to talk about what is less obvious.
That's exactly right. Here's a good example of what could have happened during World War II. If somebody had gotten wind that the technocrats were working in the early days of the rise of Hitler. And if they saw IBM coming in to provide the statistical analysis with their early tabulator machines, I think the first one was called the Hollerith that they brought into Nazi Germany. And IBM was leasing those equipment to Germany. They provided the technicians to run them. They trained the Nazis on how to use them, how to program them, how to get the output out of them, and they also serviced them directly. IBM never sold anything directly to the Nazis. They leased it. That's always been their business model. And of course, those tabulators were used to schedule the trains to take people to the gas chambers and prison camps and to work centers and stuff. And they also told, those computers told them who they should go round up and stuff into the boxcars to take. What if somebody had discovered that IBM was moving in and enabling Hitler to do these things early on? They saw this symbiotic relationship and they thought, hey, we're going to make it our point to kick IBM out of our country. And let's just say somehow they found some legal ground or some other ground to bar IBM from selling or leasing or doing anything with Hitler. Okay. How far would Hitler have gotten with his program? He would have gotten virtually nowhere. And you could multiply that by all kinds of other things that happened back then with companies that had technocrats embedded in them that had no moral values whatsoever was what they were doing.
But you can see that with hindsight, and that makes sense.
Yes.
But at the time, virtually impossible to see that until it started to unfold.
That's right.
We have that benefit of hindsight. We can point to that as an example, as you just have. But that takes a long discussion to get people to understand that. So how can we do that in the present situation where we've got these industry giants such as AT&T and Cisco and General Electric and Intel and IBM, you know, pushing this industry for? And we can say, well, that's all great, but we could point to it and say, just a minute, they may actually be facilitating something which could be very damaging to the majority of the world's population. How do we get people to see that?
It's not easy. I'm not, certainly, because the whole mindset and the whole media bias is against you. But I figure if you and I can reason through it and understand it, other people can as well. And so, you know, the audiences that I have addressed personally, where I can see their eyeballs and see the expressions on their face when I tell them this information, it's not difficult for them to understand it. What's more difficult probably is just, okay, what are we going to do about it? But until a decent percentage of the population understands what's really going on, there really will not be a solution. And I would go back to what the famous military strategist Sun Tzu said. If you don't know the enemy and you don't know yourself, you can't possibly win a war. We have a hard time knowing ourselves, for one. We do. But we absolutely have no visibility on the enemy. So if we don't know the enemy, how can we possibly fight back? You need to know who the enemy is. And in this case, the enemy is not the politicians directly, although they're very aggravating.
Yeah.
It's not the billionaires, although they're very aggravating as well. But these technocrats that are operating behind the scenes, they're hiding behind the skirts, if you will, of the politicians. But they're there. And they're the ones that are setting these crazy policies. They're putting in this crazy technology to control the dickens out of us. In our country, I could look at the NSA. I could look at the CIA. I could look at Homeland Security, the FBI. You know, all of these intelligence organizations are being orchestrated for one purpose in mind, and that is to implement technocracy. And we look at smart grid, same thing. Smart grid is controlling the power distribution and consumption of your home and business. It's not just to make life better for you so you can manage your power with your smartphone. You know, and they've admitted this now, that even our director of national intelligence testified to Congress, I don't know, just a few weeks ago, that it is possible that they will use the smart home data to spy on Americans. That is that means the meter on the side of the home and your refrigerator and your, you know, your TV and all those sorts of things you have in your house.
Yeah.
They're little bits of intelligent gathering material. And they would, you know, they've now admitted, I said this from the beginning when I saw smart grid, it's not about electricity, it's about control, it's about intelligence gathering.
Do you think that people care anymore? I mean, one of the effects of the Snowden revelations has been to sort of normalize people to all this stuff. I mean, so do you think people really think, oh yeah, I've heard that before. Well, let's not even bother about it.
I think some people will just go along with the program no matter what, and they just figure, well, that's life. And if I'm, you know, if I end up being a slave, fine. But there are a lot of people that are really resisting it over in the United States, for sure. I think I see more people in Europe wanting to resist it now. I get emails almost every week from somebody out of country. To me, I'm in the United States.
Yeah.
And what I get is, basically, the idea is, we hope that you can do something to derail this, because in our countries, we're screwed. And we see the problem, but we don't know what we can do about it. You know, we're just, we waited too long.
So what do you do to derail this? I mean, if we say that the powerhouse of all this are, in fact, these global corporations and the power that they wield, you can't derail them, can you? I mean, the only thing that I can think of is to go from a mass boycott of particular corporations that are investing in this sort of thing. And
well,
so that,
yeah, let me give you a concrete example. As Canada, in British Columbia, BC Hydro has slated to remove 86,000 smart meters from the sides of homes. This is because customers put up a big enough stink that they finally relented and said, okay, we'll do it. And there was another utility that pulled out, I think, 18,000. That's a small thing in the big scheme, but hey, somebody made a difference up there. Enough consumers kicked back against it. They said, this isn't worth it, and we can't make any money at it.
Yeah, that does seem to be the way to wield power, doesn't it? Certainly more than voting, which, of course, is all the hoo-ha about voting going on where you are. But
that's right.
That's a distraction, isn't it, from where the real power lies, which, of course, is in the pocketbook.
It is in the pocketbook.
I mean, one thing that I've got to ask you before we close, and that's to do with the fact that you talked before about the Trilateral Commission, and you've, you know, obviously in your book, you had all these names in bold type when you saw somebody connected with the Trilateral Commission in whatever sector of society it was. So there they are. There's another person on virtually every page. Yeah. So what I've really got to ask you here about this Industry 4 and the like is, you know, what evidence do you have that there are individuals identifiably connected with the Trilateral Commission involved in pushing this agenda?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Yes, I don't have the list at my fingertips, but even the people, for instance, that attend the World Economic Forum, there's a bunch of them that are members of the Trilateral Commission.
Right.
Starting with 1973, they have written extensively about their new international economic order, which was, they called that the technotronic era. That's what Brzezinski called it. And the technotronic era is virtually exactly what he's looking at. Now, they didn't know the technology specifically that was coming, but they knew it was going to increase and it was going to be more sophisticated as time went on. You know, they couldn't have said, for instance, that there will be drones used everywhere now for all kinds of stuff back in 1973. But they knew stuff was going to happen. They knew computer technology was going to go forward. They knew, you know, artificial intelligence was going to move forward. And that technotronic era would be possible to control men and control things through technology. And so the fact that we're now addressing the fourth industrial revolution, that is exactly what they have been hoping for at the very least since 1973. This is it. This is the expression of it. So now we have all these technologies, you know, coming at us at the same time. Did they invent all those technologies? No, that kind of happened. But the global elite at the top of it are ready, waiting, and able to take over any new technology that comes out, to use it towards their goals. It wouldn't matter what the technology is necessarily. They would be ready to grab it and claim it as their own so that they can use it to implement their net of control over the world. That's what the green economy is all about.
So the lesson of this interview seems to be something that we talk about so much on this show and on so many other shows, which is essentially to get people to look at what is going on, actually to share this information. It's got to the point where it's become almost a cliche. Oh, you know, we've got to get the truth out there. But that really does seem to be the case, because without information, people can't understand what's going on. They can't even begin to think of what the solution might be. But once you realize what the problem is, the complexion of the situation, then you can actually start to think of possible solutions. So I think the kind of conversation we're having now is actually important in order to achieve that. And, you know, what can I say other than to appeal to anybody who happens to be listening out there to continue sharing this information? And I'm going to recommend yet again Pat Wood's excellent book, please do go and get a copy of that. Technocracy Rising, isn't it, you called it. Why did you choose the subtitle, The Trojan Horse of Global Transformation?
Well, that's right. The Trojan Horse of Global Transformation. It is a Trojan horse because nobody sees it. It's there in plain sight, but they don't see the purpose of it. The Trojan horse is being ridden by the United Nations with their program of sustainable development and green economy, the synonymous terms, actually. But the whole business of global warming has nothing to do with sustainable development per se. It's the scare tactic that they're using to stampede people towards the only solution being offered, which is sustainable development and green economy. So it's a Trojan horse. People are not seeing it for what it is. That's why there's been virtually no kickback for ever since 1992 when they first, you know, Agenda 21 was first introduced, which brought sustainable development to the world stage. You know, I'll tell you, Christians talk about having a biblical worldview. But if you want to have a truly biblical worldview, you have to have two things. One, you have to have an understanding of what the Bible says, actually, about the world. And, you know.
Yes, it does actually help. Yeah, sure.
That's the first thing. I mean, that's important. You need to know what the Bible says. So stick your nose in it and find out what the Bible says about stuff. And secondly, you need to understand some actual reality about the world. You can't. If you take a belief system about the world as based on fantasy and propaganda, even if you know the Bible very well, if you would dare to stand up and say, well, I have a biblical worldview, I would have to say to that person, really? How can you have a biblical worldview when you're looking at a fantasy picture of what's going on in the world? You know, you have to have a knowledge of both. Open your eyes and see it for what it is. And maybe you can't do anything about it, but at least if you're going to say, well, I want to have a biblical worldview, okay, then face this data. Take it back to the Bible and analyze it in light of what you know about the Bible, and then maybe you're going to come up with a biblical worldview. Truly.
Yeah. And I would say that your book is probably the best way to do that. However, you also had a website, I don't know whether you still do, called Revelation Gate Ministries, where you are trying to help people to do this. Do you still run that website?
Well, actually, right now, it's in transition. I changed servers recently, and the site got toasted, but it's going to be it's going to come back to life on my new server.
So remind us then where people find most of your work, or perhaps all of your work, just at the moment, which is the...
Yeah, technocracy.news.
Technocracy.news, yeah, because the August Review website has gone, is that right?
It rolls over onto technocracy.news now. Okay. So if somebody were to type it in, that's where it goes. I would love to be writing about economic issues like I used to, and, you know, about market forecasting. I love that field. That was really my first love. Uh-huh. But this is so important. This whole business of technocracy is a clear and present danger to the world. And because I have the knowledge in my head now, that in my fingertips, I cannot find anything more important than to talk about technocracy and warn people that this is what's going on, folks. This is not a game. It's not a drill. This is real.
As I said at the top of the show, it has provided an interpretive framework for so much that we talk about here on the show, and I keep coming back to it. So, you know, I have to say, I do think you're onto something. But, you know, when something maps onto so much of what you talk about, you've got to ask yourself, you know, is this actually real?
That's
and
right.
That's the way that's it right. does, in fact, seem to be. It does seem to be real.
Indeed.
Anyway, thank you ever so much, Pat, for being on the show again. It is always a delight to speak with you, and always an education, because, you know, there's so much that you do understand from your experience. And as I was saying, you know, it does give us this way of seeing the disparate things that are happening in the world and collecting them together in a way that seems to make a great deal of sense. And I do hope that people do take seriously what you are saying and will look into your book and indeed listen to the previous interviews that we've had with you. And I very much look forward to inviting you back on the show again to talk about another subject that may or may not be related to technocracy. Thank you very much for joining us.
That's great. You're entirely welcome.